Hello, everyone, and welcome to NWR Connectivity episode 321. It's the Majora's Mask Game Club episode, the slightly delayed Majora's Mask Game Club episode. I am joined, as usual, by Neil Ranahan.
Spooky. Majora's Mask, finally.
We also have our usual members of the panel, Alex DeFritis.
May the fourth be with you.
And Matt Zawadniak.
That's me. For some reason, I was allowed back.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see how long you last for the Wind Waker episode. But until then, we'll keep you around.
It's more just that Zencastr links are hilariously easy to guess. And if you can guess the link, you can join the podcast.
There's an extra level of security, apparently, because Firefox isn't supported.
That's true. That and Netscape. So you're pretty much screwed.
Put away that navigator, son.
Yeah. But yes, we are here to talk about Majora's Mask. And to start, as we usually do with these game clubs, let's go through when each of us were first introduced to the game, how we played it, and maybe some of our initial impressions of it. Alex, as the alphabetical first person, why don't you start us off?
Sure, yeah. So I've been a fan of Majora's Mask for well over a decade, but I didn't play it until the end of last year.
you're an Earthbound fan.
Yes, I'm an
Wait, what? Like is that a bit that you've considered yourself a fan of the game, but you haven't played it?
Well, I would say that I've been a fan of, like, via osmosis, I've experienced a lot of the game
the
via, like, fan
of
works.
Majora's Mask.
The concept of a video game sounds cool.
No, but for real, like, the music and the setting stuff.
I get you with that, because I can think of, like, some, I can't think of one off the top of my head, but, like, some, I mean, Legend of Mana, that's a game I didn't play until last year on Switch. That soundtrack's incredible. I have listened to the soundtrack and was excited for the Switch release on the basis of the soundtrack.
Yeah, it's like when I walked in here and was like, I played Super Metroid for the first time in 2019.
Yeah. There always has to be one.
It's very much like that. No, I had an N64, but I never had Ocarina of Time or Majora's Mask. I think the first time I experienced Majora's Mask was at a friend's house. And I didn't get to play it myself until 2013 on the Wii U. And that was short-lived because I then started college, and then by the time the 3DS version came out, I played that a little bit because I borrowed it from a friend, but then they had to move on, so I lost that copy, and I didn't get to actually sit down and play through it from beginning to end until last year. But I've always been interested. Stuff like Ben Drowned, I was really into, like, Peanut Butter Gamer back, 10 years ago, and he did a lot of stuff on Majora's Mask on YouTube. And so I've been a fan kind of like at an arm's distance, but after playing it, I am much more of a fan. And in fact, it's in the running to maybe beat Wind Waker. I'm very curious to
you
see
and
how
I
things
are both
play
just
out.
Like paranoid that we're going to play Wind Waker and hate it.
Well, I've got a head start with some bad news.
Well, I was worried about what you were saying until you explained what your reasonings were. And then I was like, oh, OK, I'm probably going to be fine.
Matt.
So this is a game that I actually have memories of playing on day one. I would have been like 7 years old at the time. And I remember I died from the moon hitting the earth and killing everyone. And like, I was talking to my mom, like, oh, I lost. And she was like, you lost? I thought you had 3 days. That was like 20 minutes. Because those 3 days are a lot faster than you think.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah. But I think I've said plenty of times already that this one it's my favorite game in the series. And I don't see that ever changing unless something completely wild happens. Like, the reasons that this game is my favorite Zelda game, its depressing tone and how emotional the characters can get, that kind of stuff is the stuff that I just don't expect we'll ever see in the same way in Zelda again. And on top of that, with it being, you know, all of those things that are so unique and so personally appealing to me, it also is just really good at being a Zelda game, in my opinion. The dungeons are all really good. I really like the side quests. I think that the graphics are great, both on N64 and 3DS. The music is incredible. It is a uniquely, specifically appealing to me game, while also just being a really great Zelda game. And this is something that was like reaffirmed for me when I played it for Smashterpieces around 2 years ago now. And like that whole playthrough, you can find me, you'll watch me play that game. And at the end of it, I do like a big mega cycle where I go back and I do as much of the game's content as you can possibly do in 1 3-day cycle before actually finishing it. And that's like the most satisfying way to do it, where like the canon route is the one where you do everything.
The perfect Groundhog's Day.
Yeah. And it's a game that I'm 100% confident at the end of this game club, it's still going to be at the top of my list. And I find it very unlikely that it will ever be dethroned by another game in this series. And I'm not willing to call any particular game my single favorite game ever, because that is just such a difficult and nebulous criteria to figure out. But this one is always in that conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, this is going to be like the Metroid Fusion episode of the Metroid Game Club, where we all come in and go, oh, we all like this game. All right, cool.
There's not really a debate. It's good.
Neil, what's your history with this game?
So as we talked about in the Ocarina of Time episode, like Ocarina of Time just blew my face off when I played it shortly after launch. And for some reason, it probably was a little bit more that when this came out in 2000, it's not like it's more I wasn't as actively into Nintendo, specifically Nintendo 64, as I would have been in like 1998. It was definitely a time like I was 12 years old when this came out. And if I had memories of like friends at the time, it was when there was a lot of that like middle school bullshit of console wars and crap of people with PS2s. And I think didn't this come out like literally the same day as the PS2 or something?
It was October 26th in North America.
If it wasn't the exact same day, it was very close to it.
Yeah,
let's find out.
So around when it came out, like I didn't play it. I know I had a friend who
same day.
Okay, yeah, exact same day. So it was like that was me like starting to play more PlayStation 1 games, because I think my brother had a PS1, and this was probably around the time that I was playing Final Fantasy 7 on PS1. Kind of exploring that other world that had been closed off to me. Mm-hmm. But just Majora's Mask, I remember borrowing a friend's copy at some point, probably months or a year or so after launch, and the time limit just freaked me out, instantly gave me anxiety. Moon Crash Down, like I think I did get to the first dungeon, but just the time limit stuff just really bugged me, and I stopped playing it. And that was the case for a long time. Like, you know, it did come out on GameCube and Wii Virtual Console and stuff, but I just never really touched it because I was like, well, the time limit stuff always, it always gave me anxiety and always bugged me. I managed to conquer it for Pikmin 1, but playing Pikmin 1 was always like a really like arduous task for me of like, oh, I'll just restart if I'm not going to do this perfectly. It wasn't until the 3DS version that I was like, cool. They updated some things. I really like what they did with the Bomber's Notebook, just making it a little bit more approachable. And playing the 3DS version gave me far less anxiety. I would say like the way the Bomber's Notebook is structured helps out. And also the Sheikah Stone, Hint Stone stuff, that kind of helped out as well. But when I played through the 3DS version, when it came out, I devoured it, 100%ed it, and like blown away by how good that game is, how impactful the writing is. Just like this, it almost felt like when I was playing it, I was like, there's no way that they wrote this story in 2000. They had to have like changed it for the remake, because it is like on a different level than even the game that I was probably playing in lieu of playing Majora's Mask when it came out. Like Final Fantasy VII, maybe the story is good, but like that localization is crap. And like Majora's Mask, like it holds up, man. Mm-hmm. Like it's super a well. Really well written, smart script that deals with like legitimately like difficult, hard, sad, brutally depressing issues in a way that still doesn't feel out of place in the world that 3D Zelda at the time had set up of being like this like quirky, goofy, there's a weirdo in a leotard that's 35 years old.
It's also careful never to just be like grimdark, edgelord, everything is
awful. It gets really like, close to it, but
like, it makes a point to still find ways to say that there is reason to have hope. And that's kind of like the big side quest of the game being the Cafe and Anju quest, where it like the concept of it is like distressingly depressing. It's two lovers that have been separated trying to meet one last time before the world ends, and the scene where you finally see them reunite is this hopeful moment where it doesn't matter what happens next because they're together again, and it's a moment that lets you feel that happiness and satisfaction that is still worth having in the depressing darkness. Like it's a game that is so careful to keep that feeling there amidst all of these raw human emotions that are happening.
And I think a lot of that is now it's ingrained in the Zelda DNA. And not that I think to your point, Matt, you're right that we're never going to see a Zelda game quite like this, even though when they announced the sequel to Breath of the Wild, I was like, just Majora's Mask it. And I don't think that's what they're doing. I also think that with how Breath of the Wild was received, I think it would probably have been foolish to just Majora's Mask it. But like there's elements of this that I feel like have carried through all the other games, maybe in perfunctory smaller ways. But it's something that I hope is never lost in the Zelda series. And I do think as long as like Eiji Inuma is tied to it, as long as, you know, Yoshiaki Koizumi has some kind of power on the development side of Nintendo, I think those quirky, weird elements will always exist. And I'm happy for that.
I would have first played this. I didn't get it immediately at launch, but this was at a time where people rented video games from rental stores. So I do remember like having to be on a waiting list to rent it because there were only, you know, a couple copies, and finally getting it and not realizing, because I would have been eight, finally getting it and not realizing that I needed the expansion pack to play it, which I didn't have, and so putting it into my N64 and it didn't work, which was heartbreaking, but I did eventually play it, and I think I wound up getting it for like my birthday or something the following year, which was when I really started putting time into it. And this was a game where, like, as somebody who gets really invested in like lore and story and like random background tidbits, this was a game that was like impossible not to just sink into, because there's so like it was probably my first experience with a game that had a primary quest line where I just didn't care. Like it was immediately just like, yeah, I need to go do that dungeon, but like, what's this guy doing? I'm gonna follow him around for 3 days. And like, just the way that I wanted to experience the game world just lined up so well with what this game wanted to do that it was just immediately in. And what's weird is that in other games, I actually totally sympathize with you, Neil, as far as the whole time limit thing goes. Like Pikmin 1 stresses me out to this day. And so like that, I 100% am on board with time limits are stressful. But with this one, I was just so enamored by how they use the time limit to just make the entire world just consistent and alive and intertwined. It didn't matter. I was excited to restart and like follow a different person and see what they did in a way that no game has ever matched since and probably won't. Because that's the thing about this game is that it's kind of an open world game, but a very small, compact, well-structured Like, it is just this meticulous, mastercrafted open world that really makes a good point of like, it's not about how big the world is, it's about what's in it, and how that stuff fits together.
It is a density game, not an expansiveness game.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but not dense in like an Ubisoft way.
Yeah.
Like, it's dense without telling you it's dense. It just shows you. Like, you just walk through it and see everything, and everything matters.
Yeah.
There really are no, well, there's probably some meaningless NPCs, but pretty much every NPC serves a role in the story, which, as you mentioned, is just so well structured. And you mentioned how it still holds up in terms of 3D Zelda, as far as like the tone and all that. And I would say that something that I've seen multiple people point out in a, I'm going to say post-pandemic in very large quotes, world, is how insanely accurate Majora's Mask is.
Oh boy.
To an incredibly apocalyptic, like somebody pointed that out, and I went and thought about it, and you have the moon is going to crash. Everyone can see it. It is a fact. It is going to happen. And you still have guys being like, well, we can't cancel the festival.
Yeah, now we still have to do it. Like, just think of the economy.
Yeah.
It's not going to crash. Right. And it's like looking at this game now, it's just like, holy crap. I think it hasn't just aged well. It's actually like gotten better. Like,
yeah, a little bit.
It actually resonates. That element of it resonates so much more with me now than it did in 2000.
I mean, it even hit harder for me playing through it now versus 2015 when the 3DS version came out.
Yeah, you have this appreciation for as opposed
to I'm a father, the world is ending, you know.
Right. Yeah, instead of those guys being like the silly characters who don't want to leave when the moon is falling, you're like, "No, that guy exists."
No, those are like people you know.
Yeah, that guy lives down the road from me.
It's like the exact opposite of this tweet I saw of someone saying we're going to have to retire the phrase avoid it like the plague, because it turns out people don't do that.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the thing that hit me the strongest playing it late last year, was just like how much like, oh, people just denying an apocalypse, either because they're blind to it, they don't want to accept it, or because honestly, they just have too much of their own stuff going on to even realize it. They're like,
it's inconvenient like for them.
There's like, she's too concerned with like her family's legacy and the ranch and like taking care of the cows and her sister to even worry about the fact that the moon is gonna fall.
I mean, you know? In her defense, everybody else is worrying about a moon falling. She also has to contend with alien invasion.
Those things canonically aren't aliens. They're ghosts, which is like, excuse me?
They have a...
I guess they don't
technically have a UFO. They have a lens flare.
And it's implied that the Gorman brothers are related to it.
Wait, for real?
Oh, yeah. If you talk to them on a cycle where Romani gets abducted by them, if you talk to the Gorman brothers on a cycle where Romani gets abducted by the aliens, then they'll say, oh, we heard the ranch got attacked by some Garrow. And it's like, no, it didn't. Those aren't Garrow. Wait, you have the Garrow mask. I got the Garrow mask from you guys. What do you know?
They're transdimensional beings. They're not aliens. It's different.
It's like the Crystal Skull.
I'm glad someone picked up on that. So let's talk about the world in which this game released and sort of its place in history. This is, of course, the direct follow-up to Ocarina of Time. It was made famously fast, and I think you can see that in the N64 version.
It is crunchy.
It's got some edges. I would handle it with gloves. It was the first Zelda to be directed by Eiji Aonuma, who is, of course, now...
I think technically he was a director on Ocarina of Time, but Ocarina of Time had like 15 directors.
Okay, I was going to say, I know he was a dungeon designer on Ocarina of Time.
If you want to like look at the credits and nitpick, technically he didn't start here, but this is like the
one where he had authority to like.
I guess this is the one that Miyamoto. This is the first one that Miyamoto was not like directly overseeing.
Yeah, this is when he was given the keys to the Legend of Zelda Kingdom.
Yeah.
It was also the other director credited is Yoshiaki Koizumi. And Neil, you were talking about, I won't try to relate it, but you were talking about kind of the history of him with this game and the stuff that he brought to it.
Oh, yeah, it's clear that this game inspired the ice cubes in the Joy-Con moment.
Yes.
Yes.
So Koizumi, for people that might not know of the history, I mean, he goes back to, he's been at the Nintendo, I think, since the late 80s, early 90s. One of the things that he's really well known for is essentially the entire story for Link's Awakening came from him.
Which I is think the he, best part of Link's Awakening.
Yeah. Like, I think he just did the manual for games at the time and was doing the manual for Link's Awakening and was like, oh, there's no story. Let me make a story. And then came up with the concept for Link's Awakening. So he's already got, like, I mean, like, you could see Link's Awakening and, you know, the dotted line to Majora's Mask's yeah. story as far as, like, the, you know, the tragedy at its core. Even beyond Majora's Mask, Koizumi, here, now I'll bring up his list. After this, he did work on Wind Waker and then never really touched another Zelda game because he basically became the Mario guy. Yeah. He headed up for a long time EAD Tokyo. So he did Galaxy 1 and 2, 3D Land, 3D World. He was a part of Odyssey. Now at this point, what is his official title?
Did he do the story on Galaxy? Because I feel like that would kind of track.
I think he did.
Because Galaxy has a lot of that same, like, once you actually dig into, like, what's happening in the background, it's like, holy shit, why is this dark?
Yeah. I think if he did not do the story on Galaxy, he was at least the person that was just like, we can sneak this past Miyamoto, let's go.
Mm-hmm.
And they largely kind of did sneak it past Miyamoto because he, yeah. Based on at least how the story goes, Miyamoto came in. This is a story I was talking about before we started. He came in like relatively late and learned what the story was. And he realized, wait, this is very similar to an American Hollywood movie and we might get sued. And you guys know what that movie was, of course.
Run Lola Run.
That's right. It was Run Lola Run.
Yeah, yeah.
The movie that everyone thinks of when they think of a time loop plot.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to think. I mean, Run Lola Run did have an impact when it came out. I mean, not like a, you know, universal, everybody knew about it, but it could have been.
It wasn't
like
an American movie. It was a German movie. Pretend yeah. I said German.
I'll cut in that recording of you saying German, like, just then really awkwardly.
Run Lola Run. Pretty good flick. but yeah, Koizumi is now he's a senior executive officer at Nintendo, which I mean he's upper management at this point. You'll see him a lot of Nintendo Directs saying he played Switch Sports Volleyball at the Nintendo Direct back in February 2022. But yeah, so Koizumi leading up to Majora's Mask, what did he work on right before Majora's Mask? He worked on Ocarina of Time. He was experimenting with another game that was kind of described as like a cops and robbers board game, which the key part to that was that you were going to have NPCs on schedules that you could interact with.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. At some point, Koizumi was called off of that game to then start working with Onuma on what would become Majora's Mask.
I think Onuma specifically requested him.
Yeah, yeah, that would make sense because they would have worked on Ocarina of Time together, so they had some history. And then they worked on this, and you know, like, we don't know exactly how much of that cops and robbers concept carried over to Majora's Mask, but definitely that idea of NPCs on schedules that you could interact with, that is something that seemed to be born of that. And as far as the overall like the design breakdown of Majora's Mask, Koizumi did, I think he led pretty much all of the design of stuff in Clock Town, whereas Onuma, fresh after his big shame of the Water Temple in Ocarina of Time, he did all the dungeons in Majora's Mask, or at least led that team.
I will say, I think I find, in retrospect, having now replayed them both recently, I think the Water Temple in Majora's Mask might be more confusing than the Water Temple in Ocarina of Time.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
Yeah, like,
I agree.
With all the currents and stuff.
I understand, and we talked about this in the Ocarina of Time episode, I can understand where people are coming from with the Water Temple being confusing, but I think with the hindsight of playing it now, it makes it one of the most interesting dungeons in Ocarina of Time.
I mean, Aonuma defends that dungeon for the most part to this day. The only thing that he admitted was that switching the iron boots on and off was kind of bad.
Which
he, the dungeon design itself, he defends, and I agree with him.
Yeah, I think the small changes they made for 3DS, the iron boots, and with the signposting for water level, fixes almost every problem. There's one awkward bombing spot still, which I'm pretty sure we talked about. That's just kind of a camera problem. But other than that, I don't really have any problems with its more modern iteration.
Yeah, not only does it have no issues with it, it's probably the best dungeon in that game.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely, I think that's my takeaway from it.
I kind of agree.
Yeah, I don't know if I have a, well,
I don't know if it would be like number one with them.
I like the Shadow Temple because I don't know what the fuck was going on. Like, but that dungeon, and then like there's lore behind that dungeon.
Yeah.
That gets crazy. And yeah, at one point you ride a ship on a voyage of the damned. That dungeon goes places.
Yeah. No, I do like the Shadow. I don't think I'd put like the Water Temple like number one with a bullet, no competition, but it's definitely at worst one of the best dungeons in that game.
It's better than the Forest Temple.
Yes, it is.
Speaking of things that are sometimes better than other things, this game has been released a surprising number of times, and like it started immediately. This game has been available in some form on every Nintendo home console since it was released.
That's one of the few N64 games that I think has that. I think Ocarina of Time might be the only other game that has that.
Well, it's deserved.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think anyone deserved the GameCube version of Majora's Mask. Like, I don't know that anyone committed crimes that deeply.
That is, when I was young, the first time I really finished the game was on GameCube.
Which is impressive just on a technical level that, like...
That it didn't crash.
I think the farthest I've ever made it in that one is just past the swamp, where I just got to the point where it was crashing so much that I just gave up.
That is the beauty of playing a thing without realizing better versions of it exist.
I don't really remember it crashing that much. Like, obviously nowadays, I can see that crashing is not the only problem, and that's obviously stuff I wouldn't have noticed at that age. But
well,
like,
I mean, it's with every game where your mileage may vary. Like, you might have just had the unicorn run when you played it.
I mean, so when the NSO N64 stuff first started coming out, and Modern Vintage Gaming made some comment about how Nintendo used to be good at emulating N64, and I said, no, they didn't. I got a lot of comments from people who claimed to have gotten through Majora's Mask without a single issue. So those people do exist. It was not my experience, and I don't think it was the experience of the internet at large.
I don't think Nintendo has ever been... Has Nintendo ever, like, consistently perfectly emulated N64 games on their consoles? No.
Honestly, NSO is... I mean, it has issues, but, like, overall, in my opinion, I think it's the best they've done.
Probably the best official emulation,
And day one to now, because they basically fixed every issue in Ocarina of Time, or at least every major
There's still, like, I think input latency in some games is still an issue, though it's interesting that it's not across the board an issue. But
which to me seems like it might be something that could continually to be iterated.
That they've patched it once really surprises me.
Well, I think, like, weren't there two patches that
there may have been
slowly fixed Ocarina of Time?
I think so. They did eventually, like, the input latency is still there, but it is otherwise fine.
I think
visually it's fine now. And like the games they've released since, like, I think Banjo-Kazooie input latency wise is fine. Majora's Mask, I still feel like I notice it, but me and Alex were actually talking about that last night. And that may be honestly just come from the fact that it doesn't run at a super high frame rate, and
it felt really pronounced to me, but that's because I'm comparing it to the 40 frames per second 3DS version.
I've heard speedrunners say that it's still not very good as far as input latency goes. I feel like as if there's anyone I can trust on it, it's probably them. But
sure. Yeah. There's, I mean, there is a difference between like
normal people, you know, and speedrunners.
Right. Yeah. It's one. Yeah. Like if it's like me saying that the SNES Classic doesn't run Star Fox right. Like it only doesn't run Star Fox right if you're playing it obsessively in some other version. So it's perfectly playable now, and it's much better than the GameCube version.
And I would say the Wii U version as well.
Yes, though I get crap for not giving this credit whenever I bring it up. I will say, as the GameCube is emulating literally the system that came out just before it, it is impressive that it is on there at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, from just like a developing an emulator in the early 2000s for a pretty recent system.
Because that is emulation, right?
It is entirely emulation. Yeah, it is not a port.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah, no, it is crazy.
I thought emulation was piracy.
Yeah, it's fine when Nintendo does it. Yeah. And weirdly, nobody gave it crap back then for being emulation, not a native port. Nobody called them lazy, despite the fact that the game didn't work.
That's because we didn't know what emulation was yet.
Yeah, it was just magic. But yeah, so they did get it working. It does run at 480p, which is cool. The same resolution it ran out on the Wii, which I would say outside of the NSO, the Wii is probably the closest to a good version they've done. Until the 3DS, which is, I would say, the definitive version of this game, but I know there's some disagreement among the
council. That if you have a modded 3DS, it is the definitive version.
I think I'd still say, even if I'm gonna heel turn on John here, I still think Majora's Mask 3D is the, if anybody were to be like, man, I really want to play Majora's Mask, I would be like, hunt down a 3DS.
Yep. And I have, like, most of my nostalgia is the N64 version. I will say, I think the art design of the game just works so well on N64. Like that.
Agreed. I think it's fine on 3DS, but I feel like there's a difference in how Ocarina of Time 3D, for example, just felt like it was the N64 game as you remembered it, mm-hmm. whereas Majora's Mask felt like it was going for like almost a slightly different look. It's a very nitpicky thing to say.
No, it's fair. I mean, it is like Ocarina of Time. Grezzo has said before that for Ocarina of Time's remaster, they made the comment that they could have made it look like Twilight Princess, and that was something they considered, because that was kind of the one at the time. Yeah. They were, like, realistic.
It was 2011, so that makes sense.
But they were like, no, we want to look at the concept art for Ocarina of Time mm-hmm. and just match what the concept art was, which
yeah.
I applaud. That's beautiful.
I think isn't that what they did with Majora's Mask as well, where they were just trying to match the concept art?
To some degree, there's not quite... I don't feel, at least from what I've seen, there isn't quite the same degree of concept art with Majora's Mask that there was with Ocarina of Time, and I think some of that comes from the accelerated development time and the reuse of existing assets. I think there was a bit more kit bashing as opposed to just like design work that was done on it.
I would say that the 3DS version does do a lot of deep, dark contrast with very saturated colors, which is what I would say the concept art.
So, much like Majora's Mask looks insanely good on the Switch OLED, the 3DS version would look jaw-dropping on the Switch OLED. And I don't think that'll ever, like, I'm not sure that will ever happen, but I would love to see what it looks like on there, because it would be gorgeous.
If you have an OLED phone, you can pull up footage on YouTube.
That's true, but it's not the same.
It's obviously not the same as playing it, but if you just want to, like, know what could have been.
I want it rendered live. It looks different.
You want that 240p rendered live? Well, I'd render it uncompressed.
Yes. That's what I played it at on N64. That's the funny thing about the 3DS remasters.
Yeah, it's the same resolution.
They're the same resolution as the N64 ones were to the
dot. More polygons.
I would say that graphically, I don't agree with all of the choices that they made, but I think graphically the 3DS version hits more than it misses.
It looks very good. I don't know that I can call it overall better. I think it's a very different looking game, but I like the game that it is.
I think it just kind of like looks astonishingly good on the N64 version. Like it's just there was less room for it to be improved. from then Ocarina of Time.
Also use that extra RAM, baby.
Oh yeah, that expansion pack. All that RAM.
It also just kind of jives well with the N64's shortcomings or limitations,
It is a late era N64 game, so they knew what they were doing by this point. And yeah, whereas Ocarina of Time feels a bit, I don't know if I talked about it with you guys when we were in maybe like the Ocarina of Time episode, but like Ocarina of Time is definitely trying to be something prettier than the system will allow it to be.
Yes.
Whereas Majora's Mask is, it knows what the system can do and has that targeted and just executes on it. Mm-hmm. It's got a bit more of that Wind Waker element of like, this art just works because it was designed for the platform that it's on.
Personally, I prefer the 3DS look, but I can totally see why somebody would like.
Is that how you first played it?
Was no, I first played it on Wii U, where it was even darker than it was on N64.
Okay, well, I can. Okay, yeah, yeah. Don't.
Well, then that
don't
would
play
do
that
it.
Version.
I just thought, wow, this is a really dark game.
Yeah,
totally
very edgy
and literally.
Since we're already talking about the 3DS version, we've touched on dungeons a little bit, but there are a few changes to actual gameplay in the 3DS version. A big one of those being boss fights. Neil and Matt, I know you guys both have opinions on this. Alex, I have no idea if you have opinions on this.
On boss fights?
Yes.
I guess I do, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Do you have opinions?
They're not as strong as y'all's, I'll say that.
Yeah, I'm gonna, like, Matt, Neil, I'll let you carry the boss fight discussion here.
Okay, well, so the most immediate and obvious change is that every boss fight now has a giant red eyeball as its weak point that was added. Like across the board, all of them.
So with having, I mean, I guess I have the bizarre experience of I basically played the 3DS version and then went back in time and played. I went back 3 days and played the N64 version. I can see why he would want to make the weak points a little bit more deliberate. It is funny that they're just like, here's an eyeball.
But that's probably a middle ground.
But the thing is that they didn't make the weak points more obvious. They added weak points and made the bosses otherwise invincible. Because you can just swing your sword at Adolwa and he'll just take damage. But you can't do that in the 3DS version.
Yeah, so that is something that we were starting to talk about it and then saved it for the show. Kind of just going through the four main bosses, like Adolwa. I think that in the 3DS version, it is a much better first Zelda dungeon boss.
Mm-hmm.
But in the N64 version, it is a much more interesting boss. But I definitely had a moment when I went to go play it in the N64 version where I was just like, what the hell do I even do?
Yeah, he doesn't telegraph what, what you're supposed to be doing, where you can. Like, ultimately, yes, you can hit him anywhere, but the game doesn't do it. Like, you've been trained by Zelda at this point to be like, I need a glowing spot, and then there's no glowing spot.
So the 3DS version is made for players who are weak.
It's made for players.
It's made for more people.
It's made for me. Yeah.
Sweet
baby Alex.
I will echo that I, having played this game a million fucking times, I got into the Adolwa boss fight this time. And was like, what do I do here again?
Yeah.
So
I mean, this was
like,
this is the first time playing the N64 version. And I was like,
like, it's not hard.
I'll try.
It's just a player communication issue, which, as you guys know, from Super Metroid,
is it in the manual?
I don't know. Someone check.
So the funny thing about Adolwa in particular,
it's in the manual.
The funny thing about Adolwa in particular, though, is that so the version I have played the restoration mod for the 3DS version that reverts some of the more egregious changes that people don't like. And in the case of the boss fights, it removes the eyeball. And in the case of Adolwa, it doesn't make any other changes. And the thing is that the eyeball was not the only thing that they added for Adolwa in the 3DS version. He has different attack patterns that are more aggressive and more interesting. And so this specific version of the fight that officially doesn't exist, that I played this time, is the best. Like, it is so cool playing the 3DS version of a Dolwall, where he has these more aggressive attack patterns that you can really cleanly react to and figure out, but also you can just run in and hit him when you see an opening.
Yeah, because he really doesn't do much to you on N64. Like, I noticed that this time. Like, he's not hard to not take damage from. Yeah.
What I'm remembering is that you, like, bomb him with the Deku Scrub, where you're kind of hovering over top him, and then you hit him.
I think this time I just pulled out... Well, that's the thing, is if he takes damage everywhere, then...
There is no wrong way. You can shoot arrows at him, and that works.
And I think that's part of what gave me the impression with these boss fights in the original version. A lot of them kind of felt like they were not done to me. And maybe that comes from an expectation built on other Zelda games.
Yeah.
But, like, I just always felt, I'm like, there's no pattern. There's no thing that I need to, like, learn and do. It's just that I need to go get him.
I think that makes it more dynamic than some of the more, like, rote things that you do in Ocarina of Time.
Right. It's not objectively bad.
Yeah.
That's why I think with Odalwa specifically, like, I think the 3DS version is a better first dungeon boss, but I think the N64 one might be the more interesting boss fight.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I come in general with all of the core bosses in this game, in that I guess there's a few moments. Twin Mold forcing you to not get the giant's masks until halfway through on 3DS. That sucks. That was already not a great boss fight.
And also the fight's bugged so that he just fully heals sometimes.
Yeah.
That's why it took me forever.
Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't have as much of an issue with that on the 3DS version, but I was like, kind of sucked. And then I saw it in the N64 version and was like, okay, so that's slightly better, but it's not like it fixes it. It's not like the 3DS version made something that was good bad. It just made a bad thing weird.
They kind of, yeah.
So how does it work in the N64 version? Because in the 3DS version, my experience was, oh, I'm fighting this regular old boss, the Sandworm. I've done this before. And then I get the Giant's Mask, and I get to go ham doing, like, wrestling moves, and I thought that was awesome. For me, it felt like an escalation.
The way that the Giant's Mask works in the 3DS version is completely new. In the original, it's just, you're the same Link, but now you're Giant. And...
it's kind of boring, honestly.
But here's the thing. The way that they do it in the 3DS version, for me, it's cool, like, for the first time you hit him, and then you just do that same thing over and over and over and over again, like, 20 times.
Yeah, that's fair. That's my experience as well.
Can we just maybe agree that that particular boss fight is just kind of actively a bad boss fight?
Well, I mean, so here's the thing. I do think that the 3DS versions of the fights aren't great, and they largely make them worse, but I don't really think the N64 versions are good either.
That's what I'm saying.
It's just a matter of preference. Like, even Georg, the fish.
I think Georg is an objective improvement, but I think you stated before the show that you have the opposite.
It's more that I think the swimming controls in the 3DS version are worse than the N64 swimming controls, and the fact that the second half of that boss on 3DS forces you to swim makes me mad.
I didn't get to that one on the most recent 3DS playthrough.
So the issue is that you like, swimming fast drains your magic, but you kind of have to in order to do the attack properly. And so it's, you kind of go back and forth between going and getting it, like, attacking, and then realizing, oh, I'm out of magic and I need to go fill up again.
And it makes
it, like, a really long, boring fight.
When the 3DS version first came out, like, the changes to Zora Link swimming were, like, kind of the canary in the coal mine for, like, wait, maybe this isn't going to be just, like, the objectively better version.
I prefer it, and I don't care who hears that.
So there is this revolutionary idea that the Restoration mod came up with, because, so, the original game has the problem with, like, okay, well, there's parts where you need more precision swimming, but you go too fast. So instead, we're going to slow it down everywhere, so now the parts where you need to go fast are annoying. So the Restoration mod goes, hey, here's this button over on the side that you're not using. Let's have that button make you go slower.
Yeah.
Which,
perfect. Yeah, because I do agree that when you're in the dungeon just trying to navigate, having you move slower is just the right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is a fix. And you comparatively need to go fast. I don't remember my memory of the 3DS version for Gyoruga, which once again, I didn't get to it this time around. My memory was that I had no difficulty with him on 3DS, where I have historically, he has been the boss I've had the most difficulty with on N64.
He's kind of like Twin Mold, where they added an entire new second phase.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not hard.
Don't you just have to hit him with arrows in the N64 version?
In N64, I'm pretty sure even when you go underwater, can't you just use the Zora boomerang thing the entire time? Like, do you have to?
I mean, you can use the boomerang. You can also just swim right up to him and use the magic to just ram into him.
I'll be honest. I always forget that the magic thing is a thing the Zora can do, which always, if I try to do Majora without the fierce. Well, that was okay. So as a kid, I remember getting to Majora without the fierce deity, and he has the move where he can grab you. And I had no memory that the Zora could electrocute him during that part. And it made that boss fight a lot harder.
I'm not 100% sure I knew that.
Yeah, well,
I need to find the Smasher Pieces VOD. Yeah, if you're
Zora Link during that fight and he grabs you and pulls you up in the air, if you use the magic, it electrocutes him and he lets you go and gets hurt.
I definitely didn't do that, but how did I dodge that attack?
Did you get the Fierce Deity Mask?
Yes, but I chose not to use it because I think the fight's more fun if you don't.
Yeah. I mean, it's not so like an undodgeable attack or anything.
Which phase of the fight is that?
Oh, boy. That's...
Is it the wild one or the last one?
I think it's floating mask one. Floating I don't think mask. It's when he has the full body, but I don't remember for sure. This has been a while.
Because the phases of that fight are floating mask, big buff dude, and strange gremlin child.
It's not strange gremlin child. It's either buff dude or floating mask.
Okay, I don't think it's floating mask.
I think it's buff dude.
Okay, it does appear to be buff dude. I'm just like scrolling through it now.
Majora's Wrath. That's the buff dude.
No notes on.
Oh,
goat.
I knew the names. I just figured.
I like goat.
Goat's
good.
Goat's easy in both versions. You roll at him with the Goron. It's
a good time. I like it.
So first a follow-up on Majora's Wrath. I just skimmed through my Smasher Pieces VOD to see how I handled the whip grab, and I killed him before he did it.
There you go.
So really,
yeah, keep in mind
you.
That
that's the solution.
Keep in mind that my story is from roughly 2001 or so, and I was 9 years old and was just as bad at games then as I am now.
And for Goat, so when I went into the Smasher Pieces playthrough, I was like, Goat is one of the best boss fights in the series. He's great. And after the Smasher Pieces playthrough, I was like, Goat might be awful.
He's not like offensively bad or anything,
he's
comically just, you roll forward and then you run into him.
It definitely wasn't helped by the fact that I had to fight Goat four times.
I think Matt hates Zelda games.
Yeah, I do.
What I'm learning from this conversation is maybe Majora's Mask bosses are really like have a good first impression, but going back to them might be annoying.
I can hear that.
I think Majora's Mask itself is mostly okay.
Yeah, the final boss I think is really good.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, the final boss is amazing. I think it's probably one of the better final bosses in the series.
Yeah, because they got Ganon out of there. Bring back Majora's for Breath of the Wild 2. Let's go.
And then whatever I've already forgot the name of the first boss, but
Adola.
Like he's fine. He's probably my next favorite after Majora.
Goat, I just like saying goat. Goat.
Yeah,
most of them are better than Ocarina of Time.
Goat is Krockemeyer in the series for
me. Did you say most of them are better than Ocarina of Time?
The bosses in Ocarina of Time? Yes, I would say that.
I don't think you're wrong.
You would say the Majora bosses are better than the Ocarina of Time bosses.
Yes.
I don't agree, but I'm not going to call you a liar.
I believe that
is true for you.
I think Ocarina of Time is like you are going to do a pattern over and over and over again until the end.
It's a Zelda boss.
Yeah, yeah. It's comfort food, baby.
I see that. I can understand that, but it's like, I don't know, the Volvagia, the whack-a-mole, just I did not like that at all. Twin Rova, did not like that at all.
Morpha.
Morpha's not great.
But Phantom Ganon.
I feel like with the Majora's Mask, it might just be could be because there's only four of them, and one of them is Goat. I just think they're a little bit more dynamic and interesting.
Goat's the goat, guys.
As much as like I'm trying to believe that like Zelda is just like always really good. It's like this franchise just has largely very bad boss fights. Just in general.
I think what we've learned is that all boss fights in video games are bad.
I mean, they are more spectacle than they are gameplay.
I disagree with you guys on Zelda. I think like Ocarina of Time's boss fights, I think are okay to good, depending on.
Well, my thing with the Ocarina of Time boss fights is that considering the context, they are incredible because they are like the first 3D boss fights that aren't dog shit.
Well, and even. Yeah, I don't want to. I'm going to say this now, and then we're going to get to Twilight Princess. And I'm going to hate all the boss fights. But I think that I really like the boss fights in Twilight Princess. Please play this audio back when we do Twilight Princess. And I'm like, these all suck.
I'll get my clip now, too. I think I like all the boss fights in Wind Waker.
I like all the bosses in Skyward Sword.
I largely don't remember the Twilight Princess and Skyward Sword boss fights, so I can't really say much there.
Twilight Princess
has some spectacle.
It came out shortly after this little game, or around, was it after? I believe it may have been slightly influenced by the Shadow of the Colossus era.
I don't think it was. They would have come out too close to each other.
Are you sure?
Almost positive. I think Shadow of the Colossus was 2005, Skyward Sword.
Twilight Princess was inspired by Lord of the Rings. One of them is just like straight up a Balrog.
Yeah. Shadow of the Colossus was late 2005, and Twilight Princess was out like less than a year after Shadow of the Colossus came out. There is almost no way that Shadow of the Colossus impacted the boss design of Twilight Princess.
I am going to just go ahead and say that they shared some homework. There are definitely some things in Twilight Princess that are remarkably just straight up boss fights from Shadow of the Colossus. Like there's like the dragon boss at the dragon boss in whatever the horrible sky dungeon. And then the underwater boss, which is so cool, is just a straight up boss from Shadow of the Colossus.
I do actually thinking about it more. And I mean, the last time I played through Twilight Princess was on a deadline for the Wii U HD review. So like a lot of it's very condensed and like just long nights. But I think I like all the bosses there too. Like
I'm sure there are some dungeons that I'm forgetting about.
Those dungeons and Twilight Princess are across the board very good. It's just that there's like nothing else to do with the game.
When you are not in the overworld, Twilight Princess rocks.
Yeah. This is something that I'll be curious to revisit when we get to Breath of the Wild. So during the review period for Breath of the Wild, I was like, okay, I can go and I can beat Ganon, but like I want to kind of savor it because like this game has been so good. Like the final boss has to be great. And I got to Ganon and I was like, oh, this sucks.
Oh, it really does. Yes.
It's really bad. Like, and like it was the kind of thing, like I was like talking to other reviewers, being like, oh, I'm so excited to beat Ganon. And I think I don't know if everybody just didn't want me to like have preconceived notions, but they were just like, oh yeah, it's great. Can't wait for you to try it. And then I tried it, I was like, That was kind of bad. I'm glad the rest of the game's so good because that sucked.
Yeah, I hope I end up being wrong. It's like, oh, I actually love Twilight Princess and Skyward Swords boss fights. Though in the case of Wind Waker, I've read ahead.
I think I like even Majora's Mask boss fights are generally better than 2D Metroid's boss fights. So we're still on an upward trend for me.
Yeah,
agreed.
So dungeons.
I think they're all great.
Yeah, they're all pretty fantastic. And while I think the time limit, like I almost wish that the time limit didn't go away or went away in dungeons, it is a good balance. And as long as you do the inverted Song of Time and don't like dilly dally, you have more than enough time.
It's honestly not as aggressive as you think it is.
I pretty regularly start a dungeon like at 6 a.m. on the first day. Like I go back in time and then go straight to the dungeon, and I am usually done before the second day, which
yeah. yeah i I always have that habit of being like, I'm going to go into a dungeon. I better restart the time. And then I realize, like, I could have just done it in that run.
That wasn't my experience. But then again, I played on the 3DS where the time just moved a lot faster.
Yep.
And I was also trying to 100% everything. So I was going for the straight fairies. And that will extend your time considerably. They can be tough to find. A lot of them are hidden pretty well. And if you're not using a guide and trying to get it done within a 3-day limit and you're playing on the 3DS, it will be a struggle. But honestly, those are the only times where I was worried about time running out.
I thought that all four of the dungeons I like a lot. And there are even mini dungeons that are really good too. Mm-hmm. I really like the Pirate Fortress. I really like the Hana Castle. The bottom of the well kind of isn't very good, but it's the only bad one.
But then it's immediately followed up by the castle.
Yeah.
The 3DS fixes the bottom of the well.
It makes it better.
It improves it. It does not fix it.
Fixing it would be taking it out of the game.
Yeah, no, I agree. I
Which it's, I think the well stands out because the rest of Ikana is so incredible. Everything you do there is every story beat you hit is just holy crap, this is good. And then the bottom of the well comes and just stops your progress. Oh man.
But it's immediately followed up by Ikana Castle, which is great.
Ikana Castle is fantastic. You got the dancing re-deads in there for some reason.
I love the dancing re-deads. They're really demystified re-deads.
In terms of the stories being told in this game, this dead kingdom that was at war and never knew peace to the extent that their ghosts are still fighting to this day.
Yep. And there's some
so
weird,
good.
There's some weird Tower of Babel imagery in there, and it's just the unspoken lore of Ikana is so cool.
Has Ikana ever really popped up in another game?
No.
There's probably an island named after it in Breath of the Wild or something.
I think Ikana is the part of the game that's least likely to ever pop up again.
Yeah, it's really good.
But there's just so many good emotional moments there too. When you get the captain's hat and Skulkita just asks you to just find his soldiers and tell them that the war is over.
Yeah.
And then they salute you and then they disappear. It's a really good moment.
We haven't even mentioned the daughter and dad in the music box house, which gave me nightmares as a kid.
Yeah.
Oh
man.
Well, it's it's so weird. That moment is that part is really great. I do really think that it's very good, but it's weird how that's almost the least interesting part of Ikana Canyon because it's such a normal story.
That's the thing is that just every beat in that section of the game is that might be either that or I really like Great Bay too, but I think Ikana overall, just every beat of that section of the game is crazy good. Man, this game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We want to talk about Tingle.
I'd love me some Tingle.
Oh, how he's a terrible businessman that doesn't know how to make money.
No, he's just a man of the people. Socialism.
I mean, he sure does charge me for his maps.
Yeah, he does.
So he's not a very good socialist.
He charges you less for the map of the area that you're in. It's called supply and demand, buddy. When there's higher demand, you raise your prices.
Yeah, but it works on me because I always just buy every map he has. So, I'm clearly his target audience of just, I ain't coming back to you later. I'm just gonna... I'm going to throw money at my problems.
Speaking of capitalism, there is a capitalism side quest where you sell real estate.
I do enjoy that.
And it's really funny how you go back and talk to those guys after the fact in their new locations and they're all miserable.
Yep.
the one that you sell the ocean title deed, you go talk to him and he's like, man, I didn't know that this was in someone's private bedroom.
The grass isn't always greener.
Yep.
So what does Tingle think a fairy is my question.
A small supple child.
That is not the phrase I wanted to hear.
What do you think a fairy is?
Well, the fairies that we see in Zelda are either the little pixie things that follow you around or the great fairies, but he seems to model his dress after what you are, which is more like a Kokiri, right?
Well, there is, you could argue that there is a fine line between the Kokiri and fairies.
Okay. But Akiri gets a fairy at some point. Like, they are separate entities.
But I also think that outside there is the color green, but if you look at like the bodysuit nature of Tingle's outfit, it mm-hmm. almost resembles the stray fairy more than anything else. It's just that
yeah.
I wish he was dressed like a great fairy. Like weirdly almost nude with boots.
Just chest That's, hair.
I need
out.
That Tingle spinoff.
How cowardly they were not to include Tingle in Breath of the Wild.
Another Breath of the Wild review story is I unlocked the part of the map where I saw the Tingle Islands and like dropped everything I was doing. I was like, I have to get to there. I have to find Tingle. And I got there and he wasn't there. And I was like, damn it, why?
The real Tingles were the friends you made along the way.
I like found a shrine or something. I guess it was worth it.
Should we move on to some listener mail?
I'll allow it.
Okay.
Sure. You'll allow it.
We're going to start with an email from our old friend, Lemonade. He says, "Hi, Connectivity Gang. I didn't play Majora's Mask for the Game Club, but I wanted to share the story of the one time I tried to play it.
Oh, no.
I borrowed the 3DS version from my brother soon after it came out. I started playing it and thought it was interesting. I got almost up to the first dungeon, but was running low on time, so I went back to the first day. I then discovered it had basically undone all my progress to get to the dungeon, so I stopped playing and never touched it again. The end."
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, that's... I don't have any contradictions for you. I don't think it actually, like, I mean, part of that game is kind of like... And I guess it does probably... It's been such a long time since I've done it for the first time. But part of that game is kind of finding those shortcuts that you can use next time around.
I do think that coming into it cold, the opening can be confusing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're not sure what sticks.
Yeah.
And what doesn't if like, you haven't done it before.
Like, I mean, kind of going into it where it's like, oh, yeah, I can just deposit my rupees, you know, start building that war chest that I'm going to need. There's some masks I can get pretty early on, you know, get that password, remember that password.
Yep. And as somebody who started it multiple times, that intro is a lot.
Yeah, and it takes a while, and then you do get to the point where you're like, oh, wait, I need to do that all again. And yeah, you do kind of realize, like, oh, there's ways to kind of do it quicker, and then the fact that, like, you really just don't have to do everything every time. But mm-hmm. it's something that you have to learn by, like, realizing that or being told that by someone outside of the game.
Yeah, I mean, it is in a way, like, it's like you said, John, like there's nothing to disagree with on the facts. That is just what the game is. But it's whether or not you think that's a bad thing, which I personally don't. I think that is part of the point. But
yes,
if that's something that you don't like, then this just isn't going to be a game for you.
Well, and I especially get if you're caught off guard by it, like mm-hmm. if you weren't ready for that. And then it does it. I can imagine where that would be extremely frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, it is. I mean, this game is not a roguelike, but it does have that little snippet of that. Where it's
not a roguelike.
Right. Like, it does have that element of, like, you need to unlock the shortcut to get back to this place. Otherwise, you're going to do that entire thing again. It's that Dark Souls thing of, like, you need to drop that ladder down so that when you die, you can then get back here faster.
So I'm actually John, as you may know, anytime that I need to get a newcomer's perspective on these games, I go to a streamer that I like named DB Geek, who a lot of times when you said, like, oh, in Metroid, like, a newcomer would never understand this, I just, like, send you a clip of him. And I'm looking at his Majora's Mask playthrough, and he honestly does something that astounds me, in that he arrives at the swamp at night of the first day, gets to the temple at, like, in the middle of the second day, and then just keeps going without restarting time.
Wow.
Yeah, that stresses me out. But if you don't know any better.
Yeah, I guess.
I guess so. He's like, he's still in the dungeon as, like, in the final hours.
That is, I remember doing that as a kid playing this game on N64. Like, I remember that stress of, like, the camera is shaking. I need to finish this dungeon. And I think that's just, maybe that's just a, it's been so long since I played it for the first time that that feels very alien to me.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, he pulls it off. Like, he finishes the dungeon they successfully. Give you
an, I feel like, I suspect that there was ample testing to see how long it took the average player to go from Clock Town to finishing one of the dungeons. And, like, I'll bet that's how they timed out the 3 days.
I just scrolled forward into Snowhead, and he does the same thing.
All right, the first time I understand it, but yeah, the
he's
second
fearless
time. Is he at least hitting the owl statues?
I mean, I'm just skimming through it right now.
Okay,
I didn't get to watch this.
That
live,
is a thing I forget to do when I replay this game. I'll occasionally reset time and go, "Oh, I didn't hit the owl statues."
I think to Lemonade's point, it's Majora's Mask is a game that you have to kind of play on its terms.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't get into that groove, then I understand completely.
It has its own set of rules. It's mm-hmm. very different from, I mean, while it is very much a Zelda game, it's very much a different kind of Zelda game. I mean, it almost like Breath of the Wild. I can see where someone who otherwise likes Zelda wouldn't totally click with everything in Breath of the Wild.
Yeah.
I can kind of get that from Majora's Mask, too.
Yeah, it is enough of a drastically different game that I can't say for certain that it's what you want out of this franchise.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard for us to make too much of a comment on it because I think everyone here considers it the best 3D Zelda game ever made. Well, I guess you guys like Wind Waker more, right? For now?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Okay. The next one is from Nico. Hey, everyone. Majora's Mask has been praised a lot for its story, atmosphere, and characters, especially since they stand out from what is expected in other 3D Zelda games. The dark and surreal atmosphere, alongside the psychological and existential nature of the story and characters, make it a standout from the rest of the 3D Zeldas. Because of this, many fans have analyzed the game and have made theories such as the Five Stages of Grief theory, which was proven false, I believe, and many others. When I read about the development of Majora's Mask, I'm surprised by how little talk there is about the themes and characters in the game. So much so that I wonder how conscious the dev team was about the story when making the game. My question for you is this. Do you think that the dark atmosphere, psychological and existential storylines, and surrealist nature was a conscious decision by the devs, or was it a sort of happy accident that came from the rushed development of the game? A second question. Do you think that Breath of the Wild 2 will be darker than Majora's Mask, or do you think the initial statement doesn't mean much? I had forgot.
What was the initial statement?
I think, was it Anuma say that, like, it's going to be darker?
I'll look it up.
So, I mean, even if you look from what has been visually shown about Breath of the Wild 2, like, it does seem like it's going to be darker. Like, the first trailer that we saw was Link and Zelda going down a catacomb and then a fucking corpse just like emits magic juice and corrupts Link. And then following that to the next trailer, then like Zelda's kidnapped, Link's got a fucked up arm, and all of a sudden he's got long hair and he can fly.
Well, like, Zelda's kidnapped isn't exactly unique.
Yeah,
he's not flying, he's falling with style.
Yeah, he's falling with style.
So here's Eiji Aonuma was interviewed by IGN. He says that the sequel isn't necessarily inspired by Majora's Mask. However, he does acknowledge how dark the reveal trailer is, even going so far as saying it's probably a little darker than Majora's Mask. It's unclear whether he's talking about the trailer or the game.
I'll believe that when I see it.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I also think that there's different ways you can go about the quote unquote darker than Majora's Mask line,
right?
Because
Twilight Princess might be darker than Majora's Mask.
Yeah, I think in a way of thinking, yes, Twilight Princess is darker than Majora's Mask palette wise. Even what Twilight Princess's story tries to be, when it's just like, oh, there's like 15 Shadow Links, Twilight. But Majora's Mask actually has like cohesion and a plot that makes sense.
And the darkness is more from like, oh, these people's inner lives are in turmoil and you are sometimes solving it and sometimes you're just like, oh, I guess I'm sitting with this.
Yeah,
really
as opposed to like there's a goo monster moment that the wolf you needs to attack with this like weird gremlin lady. Like,
yeah, and I think he nails it by referencing it as like psychological and existential darkness,
yeah,
as opposed to there's a monster.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
With regards though to the idea of like how much of the Majora's Mask story was intentional, and I've never really talked about it. There actually is an example of Aonuma talking about it, where he has said that a big part of it was that they were attending a wedding of one of their colleagues back when the game was in early development, and at that time, what was happening in world news was North Korea had just developed a new kind of missile and was going to be a problem. So they just kind of had like this thought while they were at the wedding of like, we are here, like just kind of, you know, having fun and enjoying ourselves, but like right, you know, right next door, the world could end. And that is a big part of where the story, where the story inspiration came from. It's that feeling of like how, like what is normal life with the looming specter of the end of the world over you.
Yeah. If I remember the book correctly, what happened was that a rocket was launched from North Korea that didn't end up being a missile, but nobody knew what it was. And
that sounds right.
The development team was actually in South Korea for that wedding, so they were a lot closer.
Oh, even better.
Yeah. So I think it's probably similar to that whatever happened near Hawaii a couple of years back,
mm-hmm,
where there was just that scare that, like, is something life-changing going to happen right now? Are we in the middle of it? And that contrast between trying to celebrate life and this person's wedding and enjoy each other's company while also being under the threat of an existential threat.
Yeah, and I think there's also a part of it, too, that I think is touched on in, I know Alex and I both read the Boss Fight Books book on Majora's Mask, which I highly recommend. It's a really good read.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also mentioned there that, guess what? Surprise, the development of Ocarina of Time was very stressful.
Yes.
This development was also very stressful. So a lot of
Nintendo
doesn't
crunch.
Yeah, I know. It's Mario time, baby.
It's not the Nintendo I know.
They pull in temporary support, and sometimes that temporary support is just Koizumi.
Yeah. But I do think there's some of it of like, it's just like these guys are going through a lot. Like, I think there are like I think the Anjun Cafe stuff all comes from, like, I mean, it probably comes from that South Korea wedding, but I think there's other things of like, there was somebody on staff who was like engaged or something like that going through this game and working very hard on it. And I think it's just, it's one of those times that like, you don't usually get to see that kind of like stress and anxiety show through in the game as much as it does in Majora's Mask.
Yeah. So I think the carpenters like questioning whether they're going to be able to finish this thing on time, you know, despite the world ending, they're like, I don't know if we're gonna be able to be ready for the festival. That was part of, that was kind of inspired by the crunch of the development. And also the mayor saying, don't bring my wife into this, was like a sort of dark joke that the developers had about like never seeing their wives or their families because they were spending all their time in the office.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you want to know a lot more about like the localization of Majora's Mask from Japanese to English, in the Boss Fights books, that's pretty much the only person related to the game that they have that they directly interviewed, mm-hmm, for that book. Because usually, if you're not familiar with Boss Fight books, I will be a zealot for them, and then also disclose the fact that I usually back their Kickstarters. They'll do like a season of books at a time. A lot of their books are focused on a singular game, and they'll have like generally everyone has like a couple interviews of people related to the game. As an example, like there's a really good one on Final Fantasy V that I think has a Sakaguchi interview in it. There's one on Katamari Damacy. There's one on Kingdom Hearts 2 that I haven't read, but I think I kind of want to, especially after watching Joe's half an hour treatise on the cloud versions of Kingdom Hearts. It reminded me of how much I like Kingdom Hearts 2. It's a very good video game.
You should get the Switch version. I've heard it's solid.
No, I did play the demo for it and did. It was, I had a moment of like, wait, no, like I really like this game, but I'm not going to play this version.
Yeah, I can play this on many other platforms.
I literally own it digitally on Xbox.
Kingdom Hearts 2 ruined my life. I just today bought it on the Epic Games Store, and that's the worst sentence I've ever said in my life.
I'm so happy for you.
But as to the fan theories about this game, MatPat has a very famous one about
Link being each dead. Area.
Yeah, Link being dead and each area representing a stage of grief, which I think is a great, great theory. I mean, like, obviously none of these things can really be like proven to either be true, because
I think,
who knows, or be like intentional, especially from the developers.
Yeah, no, like Anuma has said as much, that like when asked specifically about these, like, it was not intentional. And I think the Link being dead theory, I would imagine they're aware of it at this point, but I don't think that crossed their minds during development as far as been publicly known.
So Anuma said that he was pulling a lot of sad emotions, and that's why, you know, the stages of grief, he heard that theory. He's like, yeah, it was coincidental, despite he was playing with ideas of anger and denial and bargaining and all that, but that wasn't like we were plotting out the story with that in mind.
Yeah, the stages of grief are like a fundamental human reality. So yeah. It's like, I believe Aonuma when he says that he did not intentionally represent the stages of grief. I don't think he's lying, but it's a matter of, I don't think he had to have been doing it intentionally for him to have easily done it.
And even if they didn't do it intentionally, it can still be retconned into canon.
We'll see. I think, have we ever... That maybe I want to see the Zelda game that just directly follows up Majora's Mask.
Well, so in the timeline, it's Twilight Princess.
I want to see this Link returning to Hyrule.
Well, okay.
It's so, literally a fan fiction I've read, and it's great. Like he comes back, and the Zelda there isn't the one that shared the experiences in the ruined Hyrule with him. He has trouble identifying with her, and he feels truly alone in the world. It's awesome.
Here's the thing, though. He totally is dead in Majora's Mask, because we do see this Link again, and he guides you through the Lost Woods in Twilight Princess. Because in Ocarina of Time,
but he's an adult in that.
No. That's different. Yeah, that the hero shade is a different Link.
Well, in the hero shade, even if that's Ocarina Link, you go into like a weird alternate reality to see him. Whereas the Skull Kid is literally just in that world.
Yeah,
which would be in the child timeline. And the last time you see Link, even if he's not dead in Majora's Mask, the last thing you see is that he disappears into the woods.
Yeah.
And in Ocarina of Time, Navi refers to Skull Kids as being kids who went into the Lost Woods and never found their way out.
So yeah. I will say, according to Hyrule Historia, the Hero's Shade is Ocarina of Time Link.
But there are multiple Ocarina of Time Links.
Right. That's adult timeline.
Yeah.
That's adult timeline Link.
Twilight Princess is not adult timeline.
Exactly. Child timeline. So the only time you see the hero shade in a just totally normal form in Twilight Princess is when you go into a weird alternate reality. You never see him in the straight up reality of Twilight Princess, because Twilight Princess is in the child's timeline and the hero shade is in the adult timeline. Whereas the Link that you do see,
you should make a video
in
about
Twilight
this.
Princess. I think there might already be some, but I will if nobody else. Yeah. The Link that you Double do check. See, the Link that you do see is the Skull Kid, who is the only Skull Kid in the Zelda timeline who is wearing blue earrings on his elf ears.
This is like how one of my friends told me that in the dark story of Sonic Adventure 2, Shadow has the real Chaos Emerald in the final battle because he uses Chaos Control in the hero side story version of the fight, where it is hard confirmed that he does not have the Chaos Emerald. And because he uses this ability that requires the Chaos Emerald in a timeline where he definitely does not have it, he has to have the Chaos Emerald in a timeline where he doesn't use the ability at all.
That's Sonic. That's different and stupid. This is Zelda, where everything makes sense and is totally consistent.
I think that this is a stretch.
This is, it's exactly as much of a stretch as Link being dead. But I fully, this is my headcanon for this.
So as someone who just
cross timelines is where you start to lose me.
then how do you get through Zelda?
Yeah, I was going
to
say, yeah.
Because we've never had something migrate from one timeline to another.
I mean, Link does.
I mean, Ravio enters into Hyrule, and they're both basically Link.
I'm pretty sure Tingle does.
That's not a timeline, though. That's a mirror dimension.
It's a parallel. It's a trans. He's a transdimensional being.
It's like Crystal Skull again.
That's not even a joke. That's just what he is.
And I think Breath of the Wild's translation issues across different regions has kind of already acknowledged that there has to have at some point been an acknowledgement of things happening across the multiple timelines.
Yeah, yeah.
And the well-known, totally canon work, Hyrule Warriors, is all about that.
The convergence. The singularity.
Yeah, I like this theory. It makes me excited to get to this point of Twilight Princess.
So, as someone who's recently read the boss fight book, where he kind of dives into the theories towards the end of the book, and he basically lays out, like, these ideas are neat, but ultimately Majora's Mask as a piece of art is, like, open to interpretation, and there mm-hmm. should never ever be a closed, this is what this means version of the story.
That kind of like there should never be a timeline for the series.
Mm. I feel like we all agree that having an official timeline at all was kind of a mistake.
I disagree. You have not talked to Justin Baruti about it enough if you disagree with me.
I thought he hates it.
I know, it rules.
Justin, does Justin listen to Connectivity?
I don't know. We're going to find out.
Justin's issues with the timeline are objectively wrong and display narrow-minded thinking.
I think you can look on Nintendo Report and find his, like, point-by-point refutation of why the timeline's wrong, and I love it. Like, that's my thing with it, is that, like, I do think, like, the fact that there's an official timeline is almost not needed, although it is fun. I do think, like, having the three splits is, like, kind of mind-bending and goofy and silly and dumb. But I have, like, I remember being captured by how Ocarina of Time was the first canonical story in the timeline. And I think it's fun to think of the ways that different Zelda games fit together, and even how Breath of the Wild, like, plays with the element of the idea that, like, that is it makes sense to me by playing Breath of the Wild that, like, oh, this is just the convergence of all the timelines. Like, this is hundreds of years in the future. It is almost, it doesn't matter where this is in the timeline, but it is fun to discuss how these different references show up, how these things are named like this. Like, even, it goes back as far as the original games, how, like, Zelda, I mean, you had in Zelda 2, all the town names are then carried over to be, like, the names of sages from Ocarina of Time.
Which it would make sense if those were named after the sages.
Yeah.
Which they wouldn't have been, but, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. But, like, I mean, like, yeah, it is a little bit like, you know, piecemealing it together, and the timeline that was may or may not have been in any minds in, like, 1999 is not what Nintendo wound up making public to the world in the Hyrule Historia. But I still think it's just, like, a super fun thing to just, like, shoot the shit about. Like, I mean, that's why, like, why Zelda theory videos are really fun, and why, yes, like, John laying out the Skull Kid and Twilight Princess being Majora's Mask Link is like it's just, is it true? I don't care. It's fun to talk right. about and think about.
Yeah, doesn't matter.
There are pieces there that you can hold on to that tie it to it.
I mean, I get that. I read fan fiction. I have written fan fiction, but it, like, I just think the Fallen Hero timeline is boring. It's not that it doesn't make sense. It's not that I think it's contradictory. It's that I think it is narratively uninteresting.
Only if you misunderstand why it's there.
I'm gonna be real with you. Your explanation is less appealing to me.
Oh, it's great. Because it doesn't require Link to die.
But I can't call that one basketball timeline.
Basketball timeline? What?
Basketball timeline. Brian David Gilbert in the first Unraveled video explained the Fallen Hero timeline as the basketball timeline, because it's the one where him and his brother stopped playing the game to go play basketball.
Oh. No, the Fallen Hero timeline is very easy, but I don't need to relate an entire video.
Yeah, a link to your video in the show notes.
I won't remember to do that.
You won't.
Usually when I get to the show notes, I have to be like, what did we talk about? It's been a day. It's gone.
So I remembered the thing that I wanted to mention, which is, it feels like it was an hour and a half ago, this part of it. The story of the transformation masks that Link gets are, like, specifically the Deku Butler stuff is gut-wrenching and subtle and incredible.
The Deku Butler in particular took me so long to catch on to.
I honestly had no idea until I forget who I talked to after I beat the game on 3DS, and they're like, did you know this? And I'm like, what?
I love how that one, like, it waits to show its hand until the credits. Like, it hints at it, where, like, the butler says, oh, you remind me of my son. I wasn't looking for it
when I got to the credits. I then someone told me about it, and I, like, beat the game again to watch the credits, or however I could watch the credits again. I was like, oh, my God. Like, it's right there.
Yeah. Yeah, they never state it. It's just totally in subtext, and it's so good. Yeah.
And it follows the rule of threes perfectly, because you see the, like, the whatever stat you think it transforms into. Like, the little tree, little guy.
Yep.
I mean, we've never seen a Deku corpse. It could just be that.
It could just be a Deku corpse. And then the butler says that you look like his son. And then at the very end of the credits, you see him weeping at the foot of that corpse. And it's like, piecing it all together, it hits you like a truck.
And especially, it's almost like it does, because once you realize that, like, the other masks came from, like, named characters, you're like, well, this Deku has to come from somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't realize that until later, because that's the first mask you get. Yeah. But then you start piecing it.
It's almost a fun, like, if you don't catch it at the end, it's kind of a cool thing to catch your second time through the game.
That's what,
because then you're kind of looking for it.
That's this time through was exactly what I was doing.
Yeah. I will say, just to ruin this moment, that after realizing that, I then remembered all of the trees that had eyes and, like, snouts in, I think, Link to the Past Dark World, and it made me assume that all of those are just dead Deku shrubs, and, like, the dead trees have just kind of grown to that size.
Yeah.
So the Dark Darkness. World is just littered with dead.
Well, how Dekus. Does that factor into the timeline?
Each one of those started a separate Deku died timeline.
So the Deku Butler's son, he shows up in Wind Waker. He crosses timelines.
He's the linchpin of the whole thing.
So I mentioned Wind Waker, and that is our next game at an indeterminate time. I guess we'll probably lay out the schedule for it after the Summer Games Fest. But what I wanted to say is that, you know, revisiting the rankings that we made, which I really should write down what I said my rankings were, because I don't remember. It changes daily. Ocarina of Time is somewhere near the back right now. I don't think Majora's Mask is going to unseat Breath of the Wild, or I feel like I might have at one point said Breath of the Wild, Majora's Mask, Wind Waker. That might have been my top three in that order. But I think my thing with Majora's Mask, when compared to Wind Waker, and kind of a point that I'm looking forward to playing Wind Waker, even though Matt is doing whatever he can to make us all dread it. I think that Majora's Mask and Wind Waker are on equal footing for me, but I think Wind Waker might have the edge, because whereas Majora's Mask, I think, is a brilliant game that is, like, sad and dark, and playing it because of the time limit kind of gives me a little bit of anxiety. Wind Waker is kind of the opposite in some respects, in that Wind Waker is a game I just like bombing around. You can make the argument for the linearity of the first couple hours, or however, it's just like every square has one thing to do and only one thing to do on the Great Sea. But I just like, I've grown to love the back half of that game, because I just like exploring that world and spending time in it. And that's something that I did not have in my first experience, which, you know, we'll talk about in more detail when we talk about Wind Waker. But, like, I did not like that game that much, specifically the back half when I first played it. And it slowly grew on me to the point where I don't remember exactly what I said, but I gave this game a 10 out of 10 when it came out on Wii U back in 2013. And we'll see in a short while if 9 years later I agree with that chucklefuck who gave it a 10 out of 10.
And it helps that the back half is like demonstrably improved in the Wii U version. Yeah.
Which... Even before the Wii U version, I had replayed it somewhere around like early Wii and was like, oh, okay, like the Triforce quest doesn't bug me as much. Because I liked exploring the ocean so much that like it was more of a natural extension of that. But yeah, the Wii U version like makes the Triforce hunt in the back half way more palatable.
Did you guys have ranking rearrangements to do?
I don't know. Maybe Majora's Mask is now like higher than number one.
it's number zero.
It's number one. The next game is at number five.
It's just every version of Majora's Mask. Then Breath of the Wild. Then the GameCube version of Majora's Mask.
There is a lot more that I could potentially say about this that I've like been consciously trying not to, so that this episode isn't 3 hours long, and also because. Hey, I have another podcast where I did talk about this game for an hour. It's called Smashterpieces. Me and my friend Joe are playing one game for every fighter in Super Smash Bros. Ultimate, and we played this game for Young Link. There's also like an entire 15-hour stream VOD where you can go watch me play it and then do a 6-hour mega cycle where I did the perfect canon run, and I say a lot about this game and how I love it throughout that entire thing. There is roughly 16 hours of content just about how much I love this game, if you want to hear me say more about it.
For me, it's kind of hard to place it with the rankings, because the further I get from when I last played it, and the more I kind of sit with it and simmer with it, the better it gets. Like, it's still with me, all those experiences, and I really do appreciate the fact that I 100%ed all the side quests and did the entire Bomber's Notebook, because I saw so much that I'm still thinking about. Stuff like Kremia giving Romani the spiked, like, Chateau Romani the milk with presumably alcohol in order to like take on the apocalypse and maybe, you know, dim her mind or allow it to not hurt as much. Stuff like that, like the postman crying in his room and just like struggling over whether or not he can run away or do his job. I still think about it. It's a game that it simultaneously makes me feel both hollow and full at the same time. There are so many things about that game that are heartwarming, so many things that are just gut-wrenching. The fact that Link never finds Navi at the end is just... Yeah. That I'm still thinking about that, and the amount of like
she's dead too.
Fantastic fan works that have been produced from Majora's Mask, and the music of Majora's Mask. We didn't even talk about the music, which is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
There's a
fan opera being made. That's how good
it's
it is.
Weirdly kind of good. Yeah.
And it's also we didn't talk that much about the music and just how it takes what you know of Ocarina of Time and just like messes with it and expands on it. It's such a good soundtrack.
I can't stop thinking about some of these moments in Majora's Mask, and because of that it might be dethroning Wind Waker, which is like a nostalgic all-time top three fave of mine. So that I'm looking forward to Wind Waker, but I'm also going in with like I'm not sure. This could be toppled by Majora's Mask, which is a game I just played last year. This game is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I felt when I played the 3DS version. That, like, I finished it, was like, oh, that was amazing. And then the more I thought about it, I was like, I think that this might be, like, one of the best Zelda games.
Yeah, one of the best games of all time.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yep.
And that's what, like, I've kind of realized with my top three 3D Zelda games, I would put Breath of the Wild, Wind Waker, and Majora's Mask as ultimately probably three of my favorite games ever made, and like slam dunk like 9.5 at a minimum depending on the port.
I'm pretty sure in my initial rankings I think I put Majora at the top, and I don't see any reason to think that is going to change. With that, we'll probably call that a Game Club episode. You can start playing Wind Waker if you want now, like we alluded to earlier. there will be some reworking of the schedule as we see what Nintendo's plans are. Fingers crossed, maybe they'll give us Wind Waker HD and we could just play that.
The good news here is that maybe I'll be able to join for the Twilight Princess now.
There you go. Yeah, so we're going to put that back a little bit. We may, like, let us know if you would like us to do any kind of, like, interstitial game club style episodes.
Darksiders.
We can do Darksiders. We can do Star Fox Adventures. We can do Link's Crossbow Training. We could do Four Swords Adventures. Let us know what you would like us to do in the meantime. If you are listening to this podcast in a format where you can review it, that'd be an awesome thing for you to do. You can follow us on Twitter at ConnectivityNWR. Yeah, I think that's all the things. Thank you guys for joining me tonight, and we will see you next time.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Cool Olympa.